Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Now, I'm talking about a book you wouldn't expect to hear on Bookworm today, and there's a very distinct reason for it. Not only is it a very good book, but that goes without saying. I wouldn't have anything but a book I admire. The book is called The Recovering: Intoxication and Its Aftermath, and in particular, it's interested in those writers, John Berryman or Charles Jackson or, well, you name some.
Raymond Carver, David Foster Wallace, Jean Rhys.
Who were themselves self-confessed addicts, alcoholics. Some of them became sober. Some of them failed to become sober. But the book takes the pretense, the metaphor, that it's like a meeting and that these writers are among the people at the meeting. So not only does my guest, Leslie Jameson, share about her experience, she has gone to many archives, many libraries, read the unpublished and sketchy autobiography of Jean Rhys, read many books that most of us have not had the opportunity to read. Now, tell me, other than the fact that they all drink and use, or drink or use, what do they have in common?
I think part of what I was drawn to in seeking their voices and seeking their stories was this sense of deep, deep longing. I mean, and that relationship between longing and what it means to drink alcoholically or use is complicated. But that idea that each of these people was searching for to feel connected to something bigger than themselves, whether that something was truth or community or another person or some spiritual force outside themselves. But that sense of hunger, I think, is part of what drew me.
I myself have not had a drink or a drug in over 30 years. And what was interesting to me is that I would hear people say, I'm looking for the hole in my soul. And David Foster Wallace says it his way. I'm looking for the missing jigsaw puzzle piece. John Berryman has his own version. There's always, it seems, something missing that got replaced not by fulfillment, but by hunger.
Mm-hmm.
Constant hunger and constant need for more. And that need for more seems to characterize the alcoholic person, perhaps the alcoholic creative person. Now, this is a big book. Did that need for more infect you in the writing?
Yeah, probably. I mean, one of the things I try to be honest about in the book and like have no choice but to be honest about in my person is that a hunger for connection and a hunger for affirmation and the attendant fears of being left or being alone. And I think that those drive the way I relate to other people, but they also really do drive the way that I write. And I think at first I was scared of writing a big book because I was afraid it would seem like ego, like an expression of ego, and I was afraid nobody would read it, and I was afraid, you know, it seemed like most of the models of this kind of hybrid nonfiction that we have are very slim volumes, and I thought, how do you get a reader to follow your associational thinking for 450 pages? But at a certain point, it seemed to me that this was the size the book needed to be.
The book is 450 pages of text and then another 150 yeah. pages of notes. And I'll add that the notes are very interesting. I wouldn't read the text without the notes. Sometimes they're just the usual, where I found this information, but sometimes they're full of stories that are of great interest. But what I saw, okay, brace yourself, is that the alcoholic is hungry for the group who share his or her instincts. You hear your own story when you hear other people's stories. But what I thought I heard was Leslie Jameson hungry for the group of writers, and in this book, trying to make yourself a part of that group. A very risky procedure, considering that you're talking about some of the greatest writers the world has known, and bringing to the fore that idea that at least for a very long time, and I think it continues, that writers are frequently members of the group of alcoholics, whether or not they became members of the group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Drinking is really very deeply connected with the creative endeavor. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, one thing to say about hunger, another thing to say about hunger is I do think there was a kind of a hunger for company that manifested in the shape and structure of this book. And I guess I'd like to think it's more about that hunger to find resonances, and certainly in all those archives that you were mentioning. It was a very emotional experience to be in those archives, in large part because I was hearing myself echoed and finding, you know, either versions of myself that had happened or versions of myself that hadn't quite happened. I felt kind of struck through by those feelings in a way that is similar to the way I felt struck through by those feelings in meetings. And so there was that hunger for company felt there. And I think maybe, you know, it's not that I was trying to say, oh, I'm as good as Raymond Carver, as good as John Berryman, but that they had been deeply useful to me in that way, and I had felt like company to me in that way.
I felt that it's your yearning to become, in our time, the new Susan Sontag. Susan, in a sense, wanted to own the subject in the book Illness as Metaphor and then AIDS as Metaphor, that she had to bring to the subject of illness, cancer, AIDS, the history that had preceded it. You know, for Susan, illness was operatic. This was, you know, the extraordinary voice of the diva dying as she sings the aria. But this, The Recovering, is a book about what is happening to literature in our time. You got a PhD in literature, as I understand it, and much of this material was part of that PhD until you decided, I'm going to make it personal, I'm going to tell my own story, I'm even going to tell the story of a major relationship breaking into pieces as I tell the story. Now, that can't have been fun to write.
No, and it also wasn't part of the original conception. I didn't sit down and say, like, oh, I'd love to write, you know, a massive account of this relationship that didn't ultimately end up working. But it became clear to me very early on that if I was going to write about the end of drinking and the beginning of recovery, that this relationship, which spanned 4 years and pretty neatly kind of spanned the last 2 years of my drinking and the first 2 years of being sober, that this was the theater where that transformation had played out more powerfully than it had played out anywhere else.
The two of you decide, it's thrilling, to leave Yale's PhD program. to go to Iowa. You, for the second time, you'd been in Iowa for fiction. You travel with him because he wants to work on poetry outside of the academic impulse. This is an important book because the recovering by my guest, Leslie Jameson, is alcoholism, literature, writing outside of the academic impulse. We're reading a book in which the desperation of the human heart is crucial to the storytelling here, and the risk being taken, it's as if you're part of a new generation of writers that include, shall I say, Chris Krause, Maggie Nelson, people who are putting their selves on the line. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The essence mm-hmm. is the word hybrid. It's a hybrid book.
Yeah. And I think it became clear to me really early on that the most honest version I could write of this book would have to include the personal, because the personal would have been there either way. It was just a question of whether or not I was going to confess it. So I could tell you about these archives and tell you about what I found in them and never confess that I had come to those archives with extraordinary amounts of baggage and an extraordinary deep hunger to find evidence of sober creativity. But why not just put all my cards on the table and tell you this is how sobriety felt desperate in these early moments, in these early years?
I started up my hallelujah days when I was an undergraduate in Buffalo, and among the people who were the most brilliant, I was an undergraduate, they were graduate students, they were such wonderful drinkers. They would say things in bars like, "We will prove we can drink more than is humanly possible if you will provide the alcohol." Yeah. They'd say this to the bartender, and away we'd go.
Yeah.
Never F with a bartender, the bartender would say, as he would set down drink after incompatible drink, followed by peppermint schnapps.
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah. Just a couple days ago, I introduced my daughter, who's 3 months, to my grandfather, who's just turned 100. And he was telling me, it's amazing, and he was telling me a story about, he was a chemical engineering grad student at McGill. He was the first person his family would ever, you know, gone to high school or college, much less grad school. But he was telling me a story, it wasn't quite peppermint schnapps, but about a party that they had had as graduate students where they'd run out of alcohol and they had just... Somebody had the bright idea that they could just go to the chem lab, and they got this 95%, you know, atrocious whatever, and started mixing it with grape juice to keep them going for the rest of the party. And my mom from the next room is saying, "Oh, that sounds so disgusting." And there's a part of me that's thinking that sounds disgusting. And then, you know, as Carver would say, like, and then there was the other part, you know, that thought, actually, that sounds like a really fantastic idea. This.
Yes. I'm talking to Leslie Jameson about her book, The Recovering, subtitle, Intoxication and Its Aftermath.
The subtitle was tricky for us to figure out because the typical thing you put in a subtitle is the genre, right? So a memoir or a biography and none of those, part of the whole point of the book was that I didn't want any of those words to fit. And so I didn't want to call it a memoir. Many of the reviews of all levels of positivity have been just calling it a large memoir. And that feels to me to fundamentally kind of misunderstand.
Yeah, no, what it is. I want to tell you a story. It's infinitely dear to me. A writer I very much was interested in, John Hawkes, had come to Buffalo and was staying at John Barth's house. I think John Barth was watching me drink, perhaps had never seen me this way before, and he came up to me and whispered in that beautiful, avuncular Maryland accent, "Michael, you don't have to drink until you pass out. We are inviting you to stay overnight with us. We've fixed up a room for you, and we will all have breakfast with John Hawkes in the morning, so stop drinking. And it was very kind of him to think that I was drinking in order to win time with John Hawkes. Right. I couldn't have done anything else anyway. I was so nervous. Mm-hmm. Barth was such a presence for me. Hawkes was such a presence. Part of it is that one fears one is not a member of the company one aspires toward. Yeah. And you go through the whole 360 degrees of wanting to be the best and wanting to be the worst. Now, what's that like?
Yeah, I loved it. It rang so true to me the first time somebody ever pointed out that thinking you were the best and thinking you were the worst were actually versions of, they're the flip sides of exactly the same coin, because both spoke to this longing to be extreme or particular or extraordinary in some way. And you know, it has been one of the great struggles for me to learn how to exist in like middle states of feeling, to feel bad without breaking things so that they would feel like the worst, or to feel good without needing it to feel good forever, for weeks or for years, you know, to just be in that space between.
And when you're among these people who are also drinkers or users, you discover that everything you've ever thought has already been thought.
Yes.
And everything that has already been thought has already been said. Mm-hmm. So when one day you happen to say, I feel like a piece of dung that the universe revolves around, everyone in the room says, oh, I've heard that a million times.
It was a deeply humbling thing for me about recovery, that every brilliant insight that I had thought to grace the world with had been spoken before. But that's sort of the first chapter, right, is the humbling. And then the next chapter is, but say it anyway, you know, because it will still be useful for somebody else to hear.
Else. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Leslie Jameson about her book, The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Leslie Jameson about her latest book, The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. It's published by Little Brown. We've all said these things one day at a time, keep it simple, a million times over, even if we've never attended a meeting, it's entered the culture. Mm-hmm. So what does a writer do who's afraid of cliche, who's been taught, educated?
Yeah. Well, I think part of how I came around to cliche, or came to understand cliche in a very different way in recovery, had to do with rethinking my notions of why we speak in the first place. And for so long, I had thought that the reason I spoke was to express myself, that every act of speech was a statement of identity in some way. But there's this other notion of why we speak in recovery that has to do with, you're speaking not to express yourself, but you're speaking to maybe help somebody else, or to maybe say something that would be useful. And cliches have a much larger role to play in that second understanding of speech than the first one, the idea that maybe this thing you say, it's not going to be some grand eloquent act, but maybe it will resonate with somebody's life, and maybe it will allow you to say something that can kind of cross the differences between what the particulars of your life happen to be and what the particulars of this other person's life happen to be. And so I guess when I think about, well, how do you take that wisdom and bring it back into literature, it's not by filling your novel with ton of cliches, I still absolutely believe that language becomes electric and exciting and kind of spell casting when it finds ways of saying things that haven't been said before. But that idea of recognizing what's shared and trying not to shy away from that sharedness is what I kind of took back into the project of writing.
I had a difficulty with life, a difficulty with living. And these things that I learned how to say were like a banister on a very steep spiral staircase. And when I'd lose my footing, I'd be able to go back and say something comforting that had been said to me.
Mm-hmm.
And we all reach a point where our best notions are not going to help us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to reach out for the banister,
mm-hmm.
and be guided down
mm-hmm.
the stairs by the things that the others have said
mm-hmm.
before us.
Mm-hmm. It's tremendously comforting, not just for me in recovery, not just the ritual of meetings, but certain kinds of utterances as rituals, right? Saying the thing that has been said before relieves that pressure of, is the thing that I am saying good enough, right? What you were talking about drinking in Buffalo when you were young, and that deep anxiety about, am I good enough to join the club? Is this thing that I'm saying good enough to be heard? That was all-encompassing for me when I was young. Am I good enough to be in this room? Am I good enough to be in this company? And to kind of come back to well-worn phrases as moments of relief or things to grip onto was powerful.
Oh, Leslie, I identified so much. But I see in your book the same impulse I had in wanting to become close to all those brilliant writers. What does Leslie Jameson do? She is, let me see if I get it right, an undergraduate at Harvard. She goes on to the Iowa Writing Program and then a graduate student at Yale. So the need to be in every elite is present. And it's, let us say, a need that forces you to feel incomplete, to feel less than, to be constantly among people you compare yourself to unfavorably, sometimes only out of fear.
Yeah.
But it's really the nightmare of being not enough, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain witness who looks at these incredible institutions that I've been lucky enough to be part of and says, well, how can you... You know, how does that work alongside the drinking? But to me, as you're saying, they are completely connected. The hunger to be somehow not, I didn't always experience it as the hunger to be better than. So often I just experienced it as the hunger to be adequate or the hunger to be good enough. And that
Absolutely.
In order to be good enough, I had to say smart things and write well and sort of explain my feelings to the people around me and earn their interest, that idea that the attention of other people was something to be earned rather than a kind of grace was very powerful for me. And so the quest for gold stars and the quest for all kinds of affirmation from men I went to bed with, from institutions I was seeking degrees from, like all of that feels like part of exactly the same constellation of impulses. And the thing that gave me the best relief from that was always booze.
The writers we're talking about are either, they're not all writers who get used to the field of ordinary language. That's Raymond Carver for sure. That's Hemingway. You could name any number of others, Sherwood Anderson. But then we have Charles Jackson, who wrote The Lost Weekend. Then you have the other kind, the writer who's writing at a level of ornateness that no one had ever thought to achieve before, and those include Malcolm Lowry and Thomas De Quincey, the author of, what is it?
Confessions
of an English Opium Eater.
Yeah.
the first of the big confessions mm-hmm. of addiction, and that these are almost cut down the center between people who are looking to talk the common language and people who are looking to talk an uncommon language that has never been heard before.
Yeah, well, I think, so I love that, and it makes me think about this idea of whether you're understanding sobriety or recovery in terms of deprivation and asceticism or in terms of a kind of expansiveness, right? Because I think Charles Jackson is an example of somebody, and I think Berryman in his thwarted way was an example of somebody who felt that in order to write the sober novel, they had to self-obliterate their virtuosity when it came to language, that they had to kind of tone it down, make it spare, keep it simple. And that was, I think that was quite a struggle, and it's part of why neither Jackson nor Berryman was ever able to complete these sober novels they tried to write. But then you have somebody like Wallace, who wrote
David Foster Wallace,
who wrote From Recovery, one of the most expansive and there's nothing minimalist about Infinite Jest,
no,
and it understood.
I got to speak to him the week it was published. It was so thrilling because it was so obviously the book of its time.
Yeah,
and part of that was because it was doing with addiction and virtuosity what needed to be done and that had not yet been done.
Yeah, well, I write in the book about how Infinite Jest was important to me in early sobriety, but that interview that he did with you was also important to me in early sobriety. I listened to it many times and felt...
Leslie, to me too. When he turned to me and asked me to adopt him, I felt this flutter in my heart that was so crazy. Now, I've been talking about a fascinating book. I'm sure you can all hear that in the nature of this conversation. The book is called The Recovering Intoxication and Its Aftermath. Its author is Leslie Jameson. And thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful to go to these places with you.
I'm so happy to have been able to talk to Leslie Jameson about this book in this particularly intimate way. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Michelle Escobar. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Joyce Carol Oates is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.